afternoon, everybody. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Today's agenda, we have one presentation by Mr. Fred Dean with regards to effective municipal councils. So I'd like to ask Mr. Dean if he'd like to come up. And I will ask all members of councils that if you have any questions, please feel free to ask them during the presentation. That works for Mr. Dean. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. It was November 18th, 2014. And I came to this council and to a group. Actually, you weren't a council at that point. You were a group of people sitting in this council chamber. And we spent a few hours together talking about some fundamentals. And it's always fascinating to me to have the opportunity, for which I thank both the mayor and the CAO for the opportunity to return and speak to you. But it's really interesting for me to come back and speak to you again, because you now have 14, 15 months of context that some of you did not have before on November 18th, 2014. So I'm looking forward to the questions today and the discussion, and I think that's going to be the valuable part of the presentation. I'm going to cover a number of topics. No surprise, you know who I am. I'm not going to spend time on that. I'm going to go through some fundamentals again. I always start with the issue of municipal powers, because I think that has to be the foundation for everything that you do and everything that your staff do in relation to the municipality. It's really the fundamentals. And then I'm going to spend some time on roles and responsibilities, and we'll do the statutory responsibilities, but I want to talk and expand it a little bit in terms of some of the responsibilities and some of the practical issues that you face from time to time. We'll spend a bit of time on meetings, just what's effective and what isn't effective, what some of the techniques are. In my world, a basic premise around meetings that I think is really important, and that is I always compare it to kids playing in the sandbox. You need to find enough friends in the sandbox to agree with you to get anything done. And if you do, you're going to do really well. And if you don't, you're going to get really frustrated at this table. It's important to understand that principle and not stand yourself too far apart from the rest. Everyone in the sandbox has been elected by the public, and that deserves a degree of respect around the table, in my opinion. We'll talk about procedure bylaw and some of the fundamentals. I'm doing something really interesting right now. I'm doing a webinar for municipal clerks around the province. I have 93 people registered for it. It's been really interesting. I've done four of them. I have four more to go. They're every Thursday. And we're just talking about some of the basics around procedure bylaws and some of the techniques. And it's astounding. We have a mix of large and small municipalities. And the learning curve, particularly for smaller communities, is really substantial. It's not so much so in this case, but it's interesting to talk about some of the procedural issues that can happen. I'm going to mention codes of conduct just very briefly and some of the elements of it, a little bit of what's on the horizon. This term of council is going to see some dramatic changes. You're going to see a very different world by the time 2018 comes along. And you need to be ready for that. We need to see it. We saw, in fact, some of it yesterday, that one of the first steps in the process. And that's going to be an interesting debate for councils around the province in terms of what you do with it. I encourage questions, as the chair said, as we go along. If something comes to mind, please ask it. With your permission, if they could ask me directly as opposed to going through you. Good. All right. So let's get started. Municipal Government 101. All the powers of a municipality, municipal government, come from the province. And they can be found in legislation and regulations under the legislation. Everything. You can't do anything unless you can find specific authority for it. The big change when the Act got amended, or didn't get amended, but replaced in 2001 with a brand new Act after 150 years was, you're given the powers, but you're also given more discretion in how to exercise those powers. And we've seen that in some communities, not so much in others. But the fundamental concept is you have to find the power. Why is that important? Well, it's because you have no inherent jurisdiction. You can't solve everybody's problem. And often people will come to you and come to your staff to solve your problems when you can't do it. And you need to be cautious about not getting into other people's jurisdictions. Be really, really cautious about that. I talked to you before about the difference between the old legislation and new, in that size doesn't matter anymore. A township like Ear Falls in northwestern Ontario and the city of Ottawa have identical powers. That didn't used to be the case. You're in a two-tier structure, and two-tier government, the powers are divided. This bundle of powers are divided between upper and lower tier, and they're different in different places. So Peel is different than County of Renfrew, or different than other regions in the province, and you have to check the legislation to see what powers are given to you at a lower tier, which ones are upper tier, and which ones are shared. They're all in the legislation. They're all set out there. The concept of types of municipalities has also disappeared. It used to be there were villages and townships and towns and small cities and big cities, and powers were given accordingly. Now that's all gone. And in fact, you can call your municipality anything you wish. A number of places in the province have changed from a township or a town to simply a municipality. There are examples of just the municipality of Red Lake, for example. You can pick the name. And interestingly now, you don't have to do that by private legislation. You can do it yourself by passing a bylaw. That's the exercise of a power. When I stood before you a couple of years ago, I said that Section 5 of the Municipal Act is the most important section in the Act. It's really short. And it's really simple, but it's so straightforward and so fundamental. And it simply says, all power of a municipality, all power shall be exercised by a bylaw of council. Power doesn't get exercised by resolution of council, doesn't get exercised by staff or the CAO or the mayor individually. It gets exercised by this council. And you can delegate certain powers, but at the end of the day, you have to be able to trace it back to a bylaw. So if someone in your organization has to buy a piece of equipment or a pencil or whatever, you delegate that responsibility and you do it through a purchasing bylaw or a procurement policy. But the power originally rested with this council to determine and to exercise. If you want to pass a bylaw, you have to do it at a public meeting. I call it a duly constituted meeting. And here are some of the elements of that meeting. It's really basic. It has to be open to the public. Public have to have access, they have to be able to get in, and they have to be heard. The advantage you have is you have a microphone system. That's good news. So people at the back row can hear you. A lot of small places don't. It's a bit of a challenge. So it has to be open to the public. You have to tell the public you're going to hold a meeting. And that's true of every meeting you hold, whether it's a regular meeting of council, special meeting, open, closed, or a committee meeting. The Act requires you to tell the public that you are holding the meeting. So your procedure bylaw should reflect that and how that notice is given to the public, because it has to be done in a reasonable way. The world has changed now, and it's pretty much driven by the internet. You put it up on the web, people know when you're going to be meeting. But you have to have a backup to that too. You can't simply rely on the web. I did an investigation not long ago with the municipality, and they had it on the web, and the web went down for a while, and they didn't give proper notice of the meeting, and they didn't have a backup plan. You need to have that in place. There has to be a quorum present. Quorum for a municipality is a majority of council, except in circumstances where there's a declaration of pecuniary interest, and then you can go down to two. But the fundamental principle is you have to have a majority of the members of council present at a meeting. And when you're at the meeting, to pass a bylaw or to pass a motion to make it a resolution, a majority must vote in favor. So the majority rules at the end of the day. So if you have your full council, that's the same number as it is for quorum. And if you have just the bare minimum quorum, you do the calculation based on that number. The final principle, and this really, I think, sets local government apart from a number of other agencies or boards or commissions or private enterprise or social clubs, and that is that all members vote. We'll come to the mayor's powers in a little while. We'll talk about that. But one of the powers that a mayor has is the ability to vote. In fact, has one vote along with every other member of council. That's really fundamental. And we'll talk about the challenge that means for the mayor in terms of the context of doing that a little bit later. It really becomes significant. So what were you elected to do? What's your job description? When you ran for council, did you know what this job entailed? I'm astounded how many people have no idea when they put their name forward what's involved with it. I may have mentioned last time that I did half a dozen sessions around the province on people who were interested in running for council. And it was an interesting educational process in terms of what their expectations were. Many people thought it was couple of meetings a month and a big paycheck. The reality is it's long hours and small paycheck for most councillors around the province. So that's a real learning curve. And I'm sure some of you from the time you've taken office till now began to recognize quickly. So it's important to know what your duties are and what the scope of those duties are. What fits within your responsibilities and what doesn't. Go back to where I started, and that's the issue of powers and where power comes from. The province sets it out, and in fact, the province has set out in the legislation what your job is, what your responsibilities are, and actually set out the responsibilities of staff, the administration, the role of the CAO, the role of the clerk, the role of administration generally. So we're going to touch on those today because they become really significant in terms of an organization that's functioning effectively. In terms of the process. We'll talk a little bit about restrictions and limitations as well in terms of your responsibility. So we're going to cover these various offices. We'll talk about council and the head of council or the mayor, chief administrative officer's role, the role of municipal staff, but we'll also talk about members of council individually and the public. And I think it's important to deal with the issue of the public as well because it impacts on every meeting you hold and on everything you do at this table and beyond this table. So we'll spend some time on that as well. So here's the legislation. This is set out in the Municipal Act, and it says here's the role of council. And it's important, I think, for you to recognize this because you are in a ward system, as I understand. You have wards. You have representatives that go to upper tier. The first part is no surprise. Council represents the public. You are expected to bring the public's point of view to this table and at least express it whether you agree with it or not. You need to keep in mind that you represent the public. But the second part is the part I think that's really critical to understand, and that says that you must consider the well-being and interests of the municipality. Now, the municipality or the boundaries, that's the easy part. Clearly, you're responsible for roads within their geographical area, for example. But municipality also means this corporation, which you sit on the council or the board of directors for. You have an obligation to act in the best interest, not in the best interest necessarily of your ward, but you have to at least consider the well-being and interests of the entire municipality. That takes people with vision, in my experience. You need to be good ward councillors, but you also need to have a vision looking at the entire municipality. The most effective councillors I've ever worked with understood this principle, and while they worked hard for their ward, they also understood they needed to have a broad view of the entire organization, the entire community. You have an obligation to develop policies and practices. Simply put, that's your decision-making responsibility. At the end of the day, you make decisions and you set policies. And once they are in place, staff have an obligation, we'll see later, to implement those. You then have an obligation as a council to evaluate them. Are they working effectively? When do you normally do that? In my experience, during the budget. You'll take a look at some of the decisions you made, may have a staffing impact or whatever. You'll do an evaluation. That's part of your obligation under the legislation. The Act says you get to determine which services are provided. I've always thought it's more important. You don't have a lot of discretion around the services you provide, quite frankly. You're pretty much, most of them, you are required to provide. If you said next week we're not going to have a fire service, wouldn't go very far, or we're not going to clean the roads, that's not going to work very well. Or they're hard services, and you have some statutory obligations. But if you said, no, we're just going to close down all the arenas and recreation facilities, you can do that. That's a discretion you have. Would you do it? Absolutely not. Wouldn't happen. What you're most interested in my experience, is setting levels of service. What's an appropriate level of service for this community for this particular activity? And that's where a lot of your budget time, in my experience, goes. Council has a role to, this has two aspects to it. First is the word ensure. You have an obligation to ensure that the administrative practices are in place. How do you do that? Well, you do that through reports from your CAO and your administration to ensure that they are being implemented and that they're going forward. The requirement for administrative policies and practices and procedures has been in the Act a long, long time. The part that was added, though, in the last decade or so, is this issue of controllership. Council has an obligation in terms of controllership and ensuring that those are in place. Now, my guess is the majority of council are not controllers. I looked up the definition of controllership in the dictionary just for fun, and it says to have control over something, which didn't give me a lot of solace in terms of understanding what it meant. So you need some guidance and assistance in terms of what controllership means. How do you meet this obligation? And we'll talk a little bit about that, how you do that, in just a little while, and we'll talk about how that got into the Act. It's part of the overall accountability and transparency regime that the province has been building on and is going to be building on some more in the next weeks and months ahead. You have to ensure your organization is accountable and transparent. I won't ask you to put up your hand, but the question I would ask, and I often ask councillors, when was the last time you read your accountability and transparency policy? When was the last time you looked at it? In my opinion, it is one of the best political documents you have. If someone says to you, you are being secretive, you're not telling us what's happening, that policy is a tremendous guide to you to demonstrate how you are being accountable and how you are being transparent. And it's astounding. If you read that list of items, it's pretty significant. And municipalities need to be looking at situations where you do something new, you do something that is more accountable, or you do something that is more transparent. A number of municipalities, for example, recently have been putting their council meetings up onto the web, live video cast or podcast or whatever. And one of the things that the minute you do that, you should be amending your policy to tell people this is another way we are ensuring that we're letting the public see how decisions are being made at this table. So anytime you change that policy, you need to be looking at it. The theme of the Act, amendments to the Act in 2006, and they have just carried forward, are that municipalities must be accountable and must be transparent. Everyone knows the buck stops with you. Some people say to me, well, it's the treasurer that's responsible for the finances. That's not true. It's you. You set the budget. You make the determination what you're going to spend this year on your current budget. You also make determination looking out to the future on your capital budget. Really critical in terms of where this organization is going. And your capital budget, in fact, in my world, you should be tying that into your strategic plan because you need to know where you're going to be going, what's appropriate in terms of capital investment going down the road. You have other duties in other statutes. For example, I probably mentioned to you before, under the Emergency Plans Act, the head of council, the mayor, can declare an emergency. Council calls it off when it's over. You determine when it's come to an end and it comes to council. No mayor and no council would ever take either of those steps without having advice from the emergency team that's in place. Really critical, and more training on that for members of that team, the more critical it is. One of the really interesting stories was Mayor Giuliani in New York around 9/11. And he said, you know, before 9/11 happened, I used to go to training sessions for emergency planning. He said, I'd sit at the back of the room with my BlackBerry in my hand and say, I'm a busy guy. What am I doing sitting on this training all these hours? And he said, when it was over, I realized I should have been doing more, that the training is really the critical part. And you saw that come out, in fact, at the very first session after, where there was a press conference. And who led that press conference? Mayor of New York. Who else was there? The engineer and the fire chief and the police chief and the New York governor. But it was the mayor who was responsible for communicating with the public. So other duties of council become very significant around emergency planning. So council exercises corporate power. You are, in effect, the board of directors for this corporation. The Act requires that you act collectively. You have limited individual powers, as we'll see in a few minutes. You act publicly. You must make your decisions in this room in public so people can watch it. And you have to tell the public your meeting for all your meetings. It's really fundamental. There is no management or administrative functions given to members of council by the legislation, and that includes the head of council, by the way. I've been in some interesting discussions with some smaller communities recently, one in particular, where they have set up a series of committees, and they are insistent that a member of council, you know, because they have a really small staff, is most appropriate to take the minutes of that committee. There is an express provision in the Municipal Act, which is really interesting, that says if a councillor takes on any administrative duties, they are not eligible to sit on council. Now, if you want to do administrative duties, quit and apply for a job with the municipality. You need to be really careful. People talk about where's that line between management and administration. The Act is pretty clear in terms of administrative duties. You can't do it. It's just as simple as that. That's not an issue in a larger municipality in terms of minutes at meetings because you have staff to do that. Certainly it wasn't my case when I was in Sudbury. We had staff that went to all the meetings. But it's really fundamental that the issue of management be distinct from the operations of council. I've often asked councillors when I get to a session, are you busy? And the answer is, you have no idea. Well, I do have an idea. And when I get to talking to them about why they're busy, it's because a lot of the time they're trying to micromanage their organization. That's not your job. You're busy enough without micromanaging. You have the tough part of the work here, and that's making decisions and setting policy in a public setting. That's not an easy role to undertake. So if you're at all tempted to be micromanaging, it's not effective. It is not effective in terms of your relationship with staff. I can tell you that flat out from my years of experience. It's not appreciated by staff. They will never tell you that, but it isn't. And it's just not going to be effective for your organization, at least in my experience. Can we just call me Fred? Because I get confused.
Thank you. You mention here it is the role of council to maintain the financial integrity of the municipality. Great words. Is that strictly having to do with budgetary needs, or is there something more to the financial integrity than just the budget when you reference maintain the financial integrity of the municipality?
That's a great question. Let's go back. You have an obligation to ensure that the administrative policies and practices, and here's the key words, the controllership policies and practices, and I'm going to come to that when I talk about the mayor in a minute. That's one of the aspects of financial control, in my opinion. It's not merely setting the budget once a year and letting it happen. There are controllership policies. You should be getting budget to actual. How often do they get budget to actual here?
Twice a year?
Okay. You're out of sync. In my opinion, it should be at least quarterly, if not monthly. Most larger municipalities are monthly now. But you need to be seeing on an ongoing basis how staff and how the organization is spending based on what you approve to be spent during the year. And if it's 6 months old, it's out of date. My recommendation to you is get it to 3 months as soon as you can. And if you can get it to one month by the end of this term, you've done really well. I think that gets you there. So we'll talk a bit more about controllership, but that's one element of it in terms of financial control. It's not merely saying, yes, we'll spend this many dollars on roads. There's a lot more to it than that. It's a really good question. Okay. Can I tell a Mike Galloway story? Oh, no, it'd be more fun if you're here. Yeah, I'm sure you will. Send me an email, would you? I've had the privilege of talking to Niagara on the Lake Council after the last couple of elections, I guess, two or three elections. And I get to this slide, and what I basically say to people is, you can have any of these titles. And in fact, you can call your head of council anything you want now. And I ask people, what's the one place in Ontario that has a Lord Mayor? And few people figure it out. Lots still don't, surprisingly. Had one last week. And I talked about the fact that that title came from private legislation back in the 80s, around the Shaw Festival. Made a lot of sense. But then I said, you know, any municipality now in the province can change the title of the head of council to Lord Mayor. And Mike saying to me, don't tell them that. Don't tell them that. They may take it because Niagara-on-the-Lake is the only place in North America that has a Lord Mayor, interestingly enough. Mike, I can assure you, every place I have spoken to said, we don't want it. It fits Niagara-on-the-Lake, but it doesn't fit the township of Rubber Boot or whatever it is. It just doesn't fit into their world. So, but that was a conversation, and we repeated it. Every time I came, we repeated the question. Just ask.
Just take a step back, and it was talking about your financial reporting and on a monthly basis and a quarterly basis. And from what I think that's a fairly important piece. But how do you manage, for example, and I think last year, and Fling can correct me, but I think last year when you get contracts, and a lot of our big contracts came toward the end of the year, so we could have it monthly, but the reality is a lot of the invoices come in right by the end of the year or come in blocks, so you really don't get a chance to catch. Well, you end up finding it afterwards anyways, but a lot of the money comes in. So you could be going along and everything looks good, but then all of a sudden a lot of information comes in or a lot of bills come in. How do you manage that kind of a scenario, or do you just accept the fact or have to know that that's the way it plays out?
That's a great question. I have two parts to an answer to it. Firstly, I never called these reports. I always called them variance reports. In other words, how much have we varied from what was put into the budget? You can do it simplistically by saying 1/12, 1/12, 1/12, 1/12, but that doesn't work. Okay? It works for some departments, but it doesn't work for public works, for example, where it's big in January, February, March, and it dies off, and then it comes back in November, December. So staff have to go through the exercise of predicting monthly where it splits. So, you know, January, February are going to be big snow issues, same at the end of the year. If there's a variance from what staff have put down in terms of the expectations, that includes contracts too. We had a variance level of 5% in Sudbury, And if it was outside the 5%, staff had an obligation to say to you in a report, here's why it's outside. And there may be some very good reasons, because there may be a delay in a contract or whatever. But it got you the ability to see where we were. When I first got to Sudbury, we used to have this panic session in October. It was every October, and we'd shut down spending. Nobody could spend anything because all of a sudden it began to look like we were in serious trouble. If you're doing that quarterly, if you're doing it yearly, and you've got staff spend the time really giving their best guess to when in that particular part of the year, we did a 5-year running average on snow removal, on snow services. So we had a pretty good sense of where it could be. But if we got hit with 4 or 5 big storms, for example, we may have very little left after the end of the spring for the fall. But council at least knew that was coming. It was on the table. So it requires educated guess from your staff, but it puts you in the loop in terms of seeing what you've approved and how it's being expended. And I think that's really critical. So you'll have challenges with it, certainly, but it puts you at, I think, a different level that can be helpful. Does that help at all?
I think we're just going to have Mr. Wong answer the question.
Thank you, Chair Ennis. So the CAO did recommend to us that we report internally through SMT quarterly, and we can certainly do that for council. As staff, we actually have calendarized our budget, so we have actually gone through the exercise where we look at salaries, for example, depending on the number of pay periods per month, we have calendarized that. Our contracts, we have calendarized those to the best that we can, but you will see in our variance analysis, we will have things like timing differences where we thought something would come in a certain month in terms of budget, and the actuals come in a different month. So you will see that this year as we start reporting financials on a more regular basis.
A suggestion of monthly, is that a big step, or we go to the quarterly? And because everything's automated now, right? So it's
through you, Chair Innes. Let's try the quarterly first, and then we'll move to monthly.
That's what I said. By the end of the term, your goal should be to get at least the next term do it on a monthly basis. But if you can get to quarterly, and it sounds like you're doing that now for staff, for management team, give the information to council. It's really helpful. But the key is to have a really effective variant model in terms of that highlights to you instantly where the differences are. Okay, you've decided to have a mayor, so we'll refer to you as mayor throughout this as opposed to Lord Mayor or some other title. And you don't have to pick off this list, by the way. You can pick something completely different if you're... Yeah. Understand, too, that all the powers in the Municipal Act given to the mayor or reeve or warden or whatever are all the same. So the chair at the region fundamentally has the same powers, the warden has the same powers, and a reeve or a mayor. Renfrew County, 2 elections ago, right after the election, there were a number of townships in Renfrew. Historically, townships have had reeves, and they all decided they would change from reeve to mayor. They thought it had more of a cachet. And they passed the bylaw that allowed them to make the change. It ended up in their procedure bylaw. One of the most interesting conversations I have with people, and in fact, Your Worship, I had it with you, you may not recall, but I do this regularly. When someone's been on council and they run for mayor and they're elected, I like to talk to them a while after they've taken that position. Because the view of the world is very different sitting in the chair's position as opposed to members of council. It is a very different responsibility. And it's important, I think, always to keep that in mind, that you're one of equals in terms of voting, but you have other powers and influence that come into play that's significant. The Municipal Act for years has said that the head of council, the mayor, chairs council meetings. And that's been true for quite a while, except in the City of Toronto. And the City of Toronto now has the ability to appoint a, what do they call it? It's not a chair. It's someone who can take on that responsibility, and they get appointed by the mayor and supported by council. And that was because Mel Lastman, when he was mayor, used to leave the chair, just disappeared for half a day. Not surprising, council meetings lasted 3 days. You know, I'd leave for a while too, I think, if I had to chair that. So that's been there for a while, but then the province added these other words in that I think are really significant so that its business can be carried out efficiently and effectively. And that says to me that heads of council need to be good at chairing meetings, need to be effective. So you need to know the procedure bylaw, you need to understand it. You need to have a good relationship with the clerk, because that's the person in the room that can get all of you into or out of trouble fairly quickly. And in my experience, most of them do very well at keeping you out of trouble. So that's a really high standard, and it's one that I think heads of council have to pay attention to, and the really good ones do, in my experience. Heads of council provide leadership to council. Notice it does not say leadership to the municipality or to the municipal corporation. It says to council. That's part of this indication that there is this line between administration and the elected officials, and that's really fundamental. So the expectation of councillors should be that this is someone that is going to lead and direct, can provide advice, can mentor, to do all those fundamental things. It's really fundamental, I think, to the whole concept that we have. Remember those things council had to ensure were in place? Where do you get advice from? Well, you get advice from the head of council. Head of council has an obligation under the Act to provide information and recommendations. Now, let's be clear. In my experience, most mayors are not controllers either. So the question is, where do you get the assistance? Where do you get the advice? Well, there are a number of places that you can go. Where do you think you would get the advice from? CAO is a good starting position. This is longer than I thought. Financial people can, your solicitor can, your auditor can. You need to be getting advice. How does that come to council? It can come to council in a report, probably written by the CAO on your behalf. It can often gets dealt with at the budget time. It's a good time to be doing that. The issue around controllership came into the Act a little bit after the City of Toronto leased a few computers. And you're all probably familiar with this story. They had $40 million in the contract to lease them. It turned out to cost the city in excess of $80 million. Public inquiry, Madam Justice Bellamy. One of the witnesses at the hearing was the mayor, Mel Lastman. And he was asked, what was your responsibility in terms of this contract and how it was being administered? And he responded by saying, I'm the mayor. I don't have any idea what's in this contract. I'm the mayor. Which wasn't a great answer, frankly. At least Madam Justice Bellamy didn't think it was a particularly good answer. The next witness, interestingly, was the CAO of the day. And his answer was, I didn't know the details of this contract, but it fell under my mandate. I'm responsible. I take 100% responsibility for it, which I think was the right answer, too. Legislative changes came along, a whole series of them, and this concept of controllership was put in the Act and said council now has to ensure it, and the head of council has to provide advice in relation to it. That's part of your accountability, and it's part of your transparency. If you're doing a regular report, yearly report to council on that, that should be in your accountability and transparency policy, that's coming. That's useful to pick that up, in my experience, to do that. Other types of controllership could be around risk management, it can be around insurance, it can be around your auditor's report. There are a whole series of things that you can cover off in it, but it covers a number of different aspects, including the financial element that you're responsible for. Council's responsibility, as I said before, is to ensure that these are in place. Same wording, but it talks this time about accountability and transparency. Really good to have a look at that policy from time to time, see where it stands. I'm doing that with a few clerks right now. We're re-examining what the policy should look like, and I think it's really important to do. And again, the mayor is obligated to provide information and advice to council. That's part of the leadership role. Head of council represents the municipality at official functions. I don't know what the experience here is, Your Worship, but I can tell you in Sudbury, the mayor couldn't get to everything. There were just too many invitations coming in, and he passed them out to other members of council. It was really effective, gave you, each of you, the opportunity to represent the municipality, and I think that's an important function that you fill. Sometimes, for elected officials' point of view, it's important just to show up, just to be there at events. People really think that's important, and I think it is for the community. The head of council is the chief executive officer of the municipality, the CEO. If there has ever been a phrase in the Municipal Act that has generated confusion and misunderstanding, it's that one. In 2005, the biggest issue in terms of the amendments being put together for Bill 130, the biggest issue, there were two big issues, but one of the two big issues was whether the title of CEO, Chief Executive Officer, should continue or disappear for heads of council. And there were two sides to the argument. One side said get rid of it, it's confusing, because the CEO of a municipality is not the CEO of a private corporation. A private corporation's CEO is the equivalent of the municipal CAO, Chief Administrative Officer. If you look at the duties, and we'll do that in a minute, that's what it means. So one group wanted to get rid of it altogether, this title, and another group said, define it. And the province chose to define it. We'll look at what it means in just a moment. Other duties for the head, I talked about emergency. There are other responsibilities put on heads of council. So here's the definition the province gave to being a CEO in a municipal corporation. Uphold and promote the purposes of the municipality. Man, you can slide by that one so quickly and you miss the point. Let's take you to a council meeting. You take a vote at council one night, and let's be extreme, that was, what's your council, nine? Nine, it was 8-1. Your Worship, you lost the vote. What does this section say? It says when the meeting is over, when the media come up to you, you have to promote and uphold the purposes. How do you know what the purposes of the municipality are? That's the decisions council makes. You do that. That's your job. So you have an obligation to promote and uphold them, even though you disagreed with the position. That obligation isn't on the rest of you. It's simply on the head of council, because the head of council speaks on behalf of the corporation. But be really cautious. If you, at the end of the meeting, you go to the media and say, I lost this tonight, and the rest of council are, they don't know what they're doing, and this is the worst piece of democratic action I've ever seen. Big mistake. I would always start with the words, we had a debate, we had a vote, majority said this is the position, I don't agree with it, but majority said that. Respect the process. Yeah.
Thanks, Frank. Question on that, if I understood you correctly. You said it's incumbent upon the mayor, as head of council, to uphold what we collectively decide whether he or she agrees with it or not. But did I hear you correctly and say that that does not hold true necessarily for us as individuals, as members of council? And I just wonder why we wouldn't be held to the same test.
Because it's not in the Act. The Act specifically says mayor, head of council, has this obligation. If you do reading on what you are as councillors, the legislator or the case law from time to time refers to you as independent legislators. You're not in a party system like Queen's Park or Ottawa. You have been elected independently, you sit independently, you make decisions independently, and the majority of you have to agree on something to pass it in order for it to move forward. You're independent in that sense. This fits in with the leadership role put on the head of counsel. I'm saying you can speak against it after. I'm saying be careful with it, though. You are far better off saying, I disagree, but I respect the democratic process of getting there. I think that's a much better approach to take than simply the sour grapes approach that, you know, they didn't have a clue what they were doing tonight. I'm not sure if that's helpful. Okay, good. Promote public involvement in municipalities' activities. That's part of that role in the community, being out and being seen. That's going to events, the functions, and all that sort of thing. You act as a representative inside and outside the municipality, including internationally. There was an election in Chatham, Kent, I think 3 elections ago, and all the people running for mayor were told, have your passport ready. Whoever wins is going to China. You're going to lead a trade delegation to China on behalf of the municipality and others in the area. That's part of acting as the representative inside and out. That has another important meaning in my world, too. We're all concerned about economic development, particularly in your circumstance, where you're in a growing area, things are happening. But in areas that aren't growing, that things are having difficulties, economic development means keeping jobs and businesses in town. That's a huge issue for them. Here's the reality. You can have an economic development department, but at the end of the day, people who want to come in and develop in your community are going to be looking to one person to talk to, in my experience. Maybe not first, but usually the first. The other people fall in with the process, but it's really important. That's why the Renfrews of the world changed from Reeve to mayor, because they believe that internationally the word mayor, the title mayor, has more importance than the title Reeve. Really important to do. It becomes significant. The last one under the job description for CEO, Chief Executive Officer, is to participate in foster activities to enhance economic, social, and environmental well-being. That's the list. That's the statutory responsibility of a mayor or a head of council when it comes to being the CEO. There's not one word of management, one word of doing administration. I've always put these responsibilities together with the word champion. I think the head of council becomes champion for the municipality. I think that's really important. Your worship? You had me worried because you started talking about educating them, but you finished with their input, and I think it's them educating you, frankly. That's what town halls, in my experience, that's a really important part of that, is to hear what they're doing. That's part of your public role, public responsibility. Good point. She's nodding at me, Your Worship. We got it. Okay, so the head of council, you provide leadership to council, you're this champion of the community, you are the advisor to council on some key matters that are set out in the act. I describe the head of council, the mayor's role, as being the most political job in Canada in a meeting. And the reason that's the case is the expectation is that you are effective and efficient at running meetings. That's the traditional chair definition. If you read Roberts or Borino, I mean, you've got to be really bored to read any of those. But if you do look at them, that's the purpose, is to have this person who is impartial and fair and effective. But you wear another hat. And that other hat is you're in a position to vote, to influence, to participate. And the question is, how do you do that? Surprisingly, I've talked to maybe half a dozen mayors in the last couple of months about this exact issue. They wanted to talk about it. In Sudbury, I can tell you in the Sudbury example, and then I'll come down to other municipalities. In Sudbury, the mayor was somewhat of a situation like this. The mayor was somewhat raised up from the rest. But if he wanted to speak in a major way on an issue, I'm not talking about the normal day-to-day business, he would pass the control of the meeting to the deputy mayor. And he would come and sit where you are now with councillors and speak. And when he was finished speaking, take his chair and the meeting would be turned back over to him. It was a demonstration to say, I'm changing hats now. I'm now doing what I'm entitled to do, and I want to lead and influence members of council in the process. Smaller municipalities, that doesn't work very well because there are five of them, for example, sitting around a U-shaped table. What the practice is becoming more and more is that the gavel gets passed. So symbolically, the chair of the meeting symbolically goes to this other person while the mayor makes the comments. I don't know what you do here. I should have asked in advance. Okay, but when you get to a point in the meeting that you want to make some substantial comments, what happens? You ignore him. Okay, that's been my experience too, actually. Think about a way that you can symbolically change the hat. Because they are completely different roles when you think about it. It makes the head of council's job really a bit of a challenge. Maybe too difficult to do, but certainly in Sudbury, the meeting stopped while the mayor came from front and walked down with the other councillors. So, two hats. The strongest power that a mayor has in Ontario is not what's found in the legislation, it's the influence of the office. The office of a head of council, of a mayor, brings enormous influence to it. You can never lose sight of that. It's really significant, it's really important. I've said before, you have no management functions. The best CIOs and the best mayors that I've ever seen and worked with, they understood their respective roles. CIO was there to manage, deal with staff. The mayor was there to be all these other things that we talked about. And if you do those really effectively, I think the opportunities are endless in terms of your organization.
Fred, just to go back on the voting of the chair or the mayor, because it's always been sort of a perception that people have that the chairs or the mayors don't vote unless there's a tie. So I think you said they can vote at any time, whether it's a tie or not.
Okay. Throw the tie rule out.
Okay.
That's a concept that comes from some of your traditional meeting rules, okay? And, you know, so if the Lions Club is meeting and there's a tie on a vote, the mayor breaks it. That, I don't know what's happening at the region now. Does that still the rule at the region? Because that was in legislation.
The chair doesn't vote there unless there's a tie.
Unless there's a tie. But that's right. In their legislation, specifically to regions, okay? In the lower tier for virtually all the municipalities in the province, that doesn't apply, by the way, in counties. Counties, the wardens vote. The legislation says this. It doesn't mention a tie. It says that the mayor may vote and shall vote on a recorded vote.
Mm-hmm.
Shall vote on a recorded vote. Now, often, if your procedure bylaw says the mayor votes last and it gets to the mayor and it's 4-4, that's breaking a tie. But if it's, you know, 6-1 or 6-2 when it gets to the mayor, you're not breaking a tie. It's mm-hmm. You got to get beyond that. My best advice to mayors is vote on everything. There was one municipality who kept saying to the mayor, how'd you vote on that, Your Worship? We didn't see if you put your hand up. Of course, the mayor wasn't. And council decided they were going to slow the process down, and they asked for a recorded vote on everything until the mayor began to demonstrate how he was voting. It's really frustrating when a motion to adjourn is put and there's a recorded vote. You know, it got to that level of silliness. So my best advice is tell the public. You have the right to vote. I mean, this is one of the powers you have. exercise it. And make it clear. Put your hand up along with the yeas or nays, whatever it is. It's really useful. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Got the mic on. Sorry, guys. We only have audio here. At the region, we have actual cameras, so people can see how council votes. When we don't do a recorded vote here and it's audio, the people have no idea how we voted. If it actually was a camera situation, then people would see us putting up our hands. So it comes across as dead space when it comes to voting unless it's recorded. Would you say from an open and transparency situation that most municipalities need to go that route of cameras so we are fully accountable? Is that what you're...
I'm a big fan of doing the internet thing with the camera. I can never get the right technical term. Webcasting or podcast. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that. So you'll have cameras. It's fascinating, you know, some municipalities got into this and they spend a fortune setting it up. It's like they were designing the CBC or something to have the cameras and all the technical. One municipality just outside Peterborough said, we want to do this because we think it's important, and they bought an iPad. And they put the iPad on the wall at the back of the room. They have a sound system, and they just let it run. And they record the meeting. So it's pretty static. It doesn't, there's no, you know, zooming in or different people. It just shows the whole council the whole time. And I said, well, how's that going over? You know, are people watching it? People like it? And the answer was, yeah, they love it. They love that we didn't spend a fortune, but they also like the fact that they can watch the meetings and see what's going on. So you can choose when you decide to go that route. You can get really technical the way the region has with a bunch of cameras around, high tech, or you can do something less than that. Whichever way you go, I think it's a really useful service. And it's way better than cable. My life was on cable TV in Sudbury, but it's limited. If you go on vacation and you're in the Dominican Republic or wherever, you might, in a moment of complete desperation, want to watch the council meeting. Can't understand why, but maybe you would. You can do that if you have the ability to go beyond your borders. You can't if you're on cable. Really important to do. A number of municipalities that have large vacation populations, Muskoka's and up beyond, really like it because the people that have cottages or camps in northern Ontario can watch the council on the web. And they're spending their tax dollars as well, so they want to be able to see how they're doing it. So audio's good, but you're right. There's this, and sometimes what mayors will do is say, we took a vote and the vote was 6-2. And you may want to say, if it's a significant one, you may want to not make it a recorded vote, but indicate how the vote went. If it's important for you as a councillor to make sure everybody knows how the vote was, ask for a recorded vote. Meeting gets turned over to the clerk. The clerk does the vote. And the results are announced. So there are ways to do it.
My question was, and maybe it's to Fu Wing, I'm not sure who. Whose budget does that fall into if we want to do the webinars? Does it fall into a council side or your side?
He doesn't like iPad.
Through Chair, and it is the budget approved by council. So. But it would be in the IT budget.
Okay.
That's the clerk.
I think Mr. Dean makes a very valid point, especially for our regional councillors. If you are wanting to ensure that our residents know how we are voting, even at the region, I would suggest that you request a recorded vote because you can't actually see all members of council when the vote is called. They don't scan everybody. It's strictly looking at the chair, and you miss about 6 members of council. So even at that point, you're not catching which councillors are voting in which way.
Just one more comment. Some municipalities now do a recorded vote on everything and they do it electronically. City of Kingston does that, for example. So every single vote that's taken, you push a button, yes or no, and it goes up on the screen. So the technology's there if you want to go that far and get into it.
I was actually just going to mention that, because through the video, that necessarily wouldn't translate into the minutes of that particular meeting or vote, whereas, you know, instead of putting up your hand, you push a button, which doesn't require a whole much more work. It would always, on every vote, you would know how every member of council voted. And you said that's what Kingston is doing.
Kingston is doing that. They started about 2 years ago.
Okay. Thank you.
There are systems. I guess that's the point in how you want to ensure that it gets dealt with. So I want to leave this council for a few minutes. I'll come back to it. But I want to talk about staff. And I want to talk about the CAO. It's really interesting. This legislation has been in this form for as long, pretty much, as I can remember. The Act says municipality may appoint a chief administrative officer. And it doesn't matter what you call this person. It can be a CAO, chief administrative officer, lots of places, small places. They're administrators. We had a chief commissioner in Sudbury, city manager. They're a whole different town manager, a whole different. Doesn't matter what you call them. The key element is that first bullet point, exercising general control and management. That's what has to be found in the appointment bylaw of that person as CAO. It says may, but I can tell you that I'm frankly right now only aware of one or two municipalities out of 444 that do not have the equivalent of a CAO. You really need it. As a council, you need to have the one person that you can go to and that you know is responsible for your administration. I first got to Sudbury and we had six department heads. We were all equals and there was no CAO. And I can tell you, it turned into a bit of a nightmare where one of the people lost their job because there was no this one key position to make sure things were happening. I really encourage you. City of Toronto, when it was first set up, the new city, had four department heads, four equals. That lasted about a year. It just doesn't work. So having a CAO, you've got the best model that there is out there for what you're doing. So exercise general control and management, that's running the day-to-day affairs. That's really the key element of the job the CAO is responsible for. That makes the CAO responsible for performance appraisals. Council has one performance appraisal to undertake, and that is the performance appraisal of the CAO. And one of the questions you should always ask on that is, do you have a system in place for the rest of staff, and are they being done? It's really critical to do. The other thing is other duties as assigned, and in my experience, there's lots of other duties assigned. Mike knows that. He's been around the business, and lots of things get assigned, and that's appropriate. Council should be doing that with it. But the key one is this exercising general management and control. This is out of the Act, and frankly, I think the province got this one right. I think this really reflects how municipalities function. So it's the responsibility of administration to undertake research and provide advice to council. What does that mean? Those are the reports you're getting, the information you're being provided. If I'm right in my assumption, and I know I'm right in my assumption, that all you, not all, but your primary responsibility is to make good decisions, you need good input. You need good information to do that. Writing staff reports is a real skill. And if you're getting good staff reports, you're getting good, solid information, you need to be relying upon that. You should be asking questions. If you get reports on the weekend and you're not sure about something, call the person who wrote it or the department head or CAO before the meeting and ask the question. It really helps staff and it will help you as well. And it will make your meetings more effective. And if it's a question that it's a kind of a wow moment for staff saying, I'm going to tell the rest of council that, you can explain it at the meeting or you can send out an email ahead of time. You can do whatever. But I really encourage you to create this dialogue before the meeting begins. It will give you assistance in answering questions. It will also give staff some assistance as well. So undertaking research and providing advice are the reports that staff do to bring information to council. you put a bullet point between the first and second one, it would say council makes a decision. That's your role in it. Council makes a decision. Once you've made a decision, staff implement it. Staff have an obligation to implement it. Did I tell you about dogs in Sudbury the last time I was here? Let me tell you about dogs in Sudbury. I was instructed by council to go to the Ontario Provincial Police with respect to the executive director of the Sudbury SPCA, which I did. And as a result, there was a criminal investigation, charges were laid. And the city had used the SPCA for everything, canine control, pounding, bylaw enforcement, whatever. And the decision was, or the question was, what do we do now? What does the city do? Because we have the dogs, we have nothing controlling. So the city engineer at the time, some of you will remember Peter Wong, who later became mayor of the city of Sudbury. Peter and I worked on a report to council, and it simply said, we can do this in-house. We got lots of facilities. We're good at bylaw enforcement. We'll do it. And we had a detailed report. We set out some other options, but that was our recommendation, and it was clear. At 6:30 that night, the Tuesday night of the council meeting, I sat in the mayor's office, and we were talking about a number of issues, and we got to this one, and he was 100% on side with the recommendation, 100%. We got to the council meeting, and he kicked off the debate. He didn't move from his chair, but he kicked off the debate. And it started by saying, Peter Wong and Fred Dean don't like dogs. You're kind of looking around. Where did that come from? And his point was, we can do bylaw enforcement at the city, but we need someone who loves dogs to run the pound. And these two guys don't love dogs. Do you think that influenced council? Absolutely. The debate went on for 2 hours plus. It was a really interesting evening. And at the end of the day, council agreed. So we now have a report saying one thing. We have council saying something else. What's staff's obligation? Staff's obligation is to implement it. And we did. We found a lady named Marie who loved dogs. She ran the pound for years and years and years, and she was really good. We took over bylaw enforcement, and it was a terrific relationship. What happened between 6:30 and 7:30? I have no idea. Never asked the mayor what the difference was, why he changed from where he was at 6:30. Didn't matter. To me, it didn't matter at all. Council had a good debate. They had a good discussion. They came to a reasonable solution, and they moved forward. So our job then was to implement what was put in place. Really fundamental to the whole process. In my experience, most municipalities that are running really well, staff and council are on the same page for a lot of issues. So you're agreeing with the staff reports. I had a councillor not long ago say to me, you know, Fred, council's a rubber stamp. We just rubber stamp everything that council staff puts in front of us. They're running the place. And my response to that is, you are so lucky you have no idea. Because what's happening is you're on the same page. That means your staff and you are working really well together. It's the organizations where council isn't accepting anything that staff is putting in front of them, and there's this huge level of distrust throughout the organization. Understand this. If staff reports are coming to you and you don't agree, you have every right to disagree with it or to ask more questions or to get more detail or to get other options put. It's your decision at the end of the day. But it's a really telling sign for me how often the staff recommendations. In my entire career in Sudbury, 23 years of it, I may have had 4 things overturned by council. Wasn't big. I never lost sleep on one of them except this one I told you about the dogs, and that's only because I thought it was so funny. It's a great lesson, too, for mayors, frankly, in framing a story before it happens. He was the absolute best at framing issues in a way that everybody understood. We had a huge issue around the library at one point, whether to fix up the main library or to build a brand new one. Difference was $2 million, $3 million. he started that debate that evening by saying, it was March, by the way. So in your head in March in Northern Ontario, it's like a roller coaster when the frost is coming out of the roads. He started the debate by saying, this is an issue of bumps or books. Council chamber was packed, was on television. Where do you think people landed in March with the frost coming out? They landed on the bumps. So the budget got approved at the lower level. But it's another example of how a mayor can take an issue and put a, think about a phrase or a wording that will really assist. And that's part of the leadership. They were two memorable nights for me in terms of how that particular mayor could frame things and bring them forward to council. It was really interesting. You have an obligation as council to ensure those practices and procedures are in place. Staff have the obligation to establish them. They have lots of procedures that, frankly, you'll never see. They're administrative. They're there. They're making the place work. You don't need to see them. You just need to be assured by your staff that they are in place and that they are happening. How many statutory officers are in the room? Statutory officers are people who, I described them one time as being special people in your organization, and a lady came up to me after and said, I've worked here 20 years, I'm special too. She wasn't a statutory officer, but you have some unique people in your organization. These are people that are appointed by bylaw of council. That's an exercise of power. And once you appoint them to that office, the clerk, the fire chief, the chief building official, the treasurer, once they're appointed, they have a job description, in effect, given to them by the province. And here's the key. You can't mess with that. You can't say to a chief building official, no, don't issue that permit. That's a bad idea. Or, you know, issue it because he's a good friend of mine. Doesn't work. The province gives the job description, gives those responsibilities and duties to the people. So they, in effect, have two job descriptions. They have the one the municipality applies to them, and they have the one the province does. The key element is the council. Neither council nor senior administration can interfere with the statutory duties imposed. It's really fundamental. Talked about the fact you are public officials and you represent both the ward and the municipality as a whole, and I think that's really important. You have limited individual powers. Your power rests at this table on the votes that you take and the influence that you have on other people. You have limited individual powers in terms of what documents within the municipality you're entitled to see. You're not entitled to see any documents that you do not require to fulfill your job description, your job mandate, as set out in the legislation. Makes sense. I've talked about the administrative or management functions in terms of you're restricted from getting into those areas. And I've talked about the responsibility of setting policy and making decisions. At the end of the day, that's a really important job. That's the most significant job in the municipality. Because you do it, not only do you have to make decisions, but you have to do it in a fishbowl. You have to tell the public. You have to invite them. They get to see how you're making decisions. That's not easy. People get on council, and that's a brand new world. Particularly if you've come from the private sector and you've sat in a boardroom, it's a very different environment. So it's a real challenge. And the more you can accept that you have to do that in a public context, I think the more effective it is for you. Here's what the public thinks that you should be doing or the expectations they have. They want their services delivered efficiently and effectively. That's your budget process. They want a staff that's able to do that, and so do you. They expect you to respond to emergencies. That's 9/11, but we've seen lots more than that, where there's an emergency in the community. It could be of any context. They want you. They expect this organization is going to take the lead on emergencies. They want you to be creative. Sometimes it gets argued that members of council get creative with what is now a four-year window. It used to be three and it used to be two, and you don't look much beyond that window for creativity. You really need to. You need to have a strategic plan. You need to be looking out. I don't know how you do a long-term capital budget if you aren't thinking creatively 10 years or 15 years. My colleague, many of you know Nigel Bellchamber, talks about doing capital budgets, and his view now is no municipality should do a capital budget under 40 years. You should be looking out 40 years. Do you have any bridges? Yeah. I think so. The point is, a bridge has a lifespan of, what, 80 years? 40 years, it gets a major remake. 20 years, it gets a... When are you plugging it in next? When is it in? Systems that have, you have public works equipment, you have fire trucks, you have some municipalities, huge transit systems. When do you buy that capital? When do you replace the arena? When do you replace this building? You need to be thinking long term. Not that you're bound to that date, but you've at least got the acknowledgement that expenditure is coming at some point in the future. And the ideal capital budget is not to have it look like this, but to have it flattened out. So you need to be looking long term. That's not some councillor's expectation. You're here for 4 years, that's as far as you're going to look. I think that's unfortunate if you do. I walked in today, I was standing at the counter in the clerk's area, and there's little signs hanging off string from the, and it's, what did it say? Town ambassador, I was going to say, what a cool idea. I'm a huge fan of believing that every person on council, every person on a committee of council, but equally as important, every member of staff is a town ambassador. I took that role seriously when I was in Sudbury. In fact, I used to go to a meeting of city solicitors around the province, and I used to be politely asked to give it a rest after a while because I wanted to sell Sudbury every chance I had the opportunity. You need to do that. It really makes a difference for your community. And if you're doing it at the town hall level, that's really cool. That's one of the neatest things I've seen recently. We need a break. Can I go for five more minutes and give you a rest? Here's a few comments around council staff relations. You should expect professional advice. It's really important to receive professional advice, and it should be delivered to you in an effective package, good reports, easily readable. Staff are not public officials. You are. You need to keep that in mind. You need to have a respect for the roles that people fulfill. All your roles are different. If you're sitting at this table, you all went through the same process. You got elected. Your staff have been hired to do specific jobs. Respect the job that they have and that they have put in place. If you're looking for advice from staff, if you're coming to staff for advice, one of the things that certainly drove me crazy, but I'll share with you how staff dealt with it in Sudbury, we'd get a counselor from time to time who would shop opinions. In other words, they would go to one staff member, and then they go to another, and they always seem to end up in my office. And I always started with the question, who else have you talked to? And I can tell you there was a network at staff, and we talked about who was shopping opinions. You're being really disrespectful of staff if you're doing that. Be really cautious about it. If there's an underlying reason for it, you need to look at that. But just generally shopping opinions can, I think, create some really hard feelings amongst your organization. You need to be cautious. Staff should be, expect members to be prepared. I was in Brampton years ago. I worked in Brampton. That was the second stop on my municipal career after Scarborough. And we had one member of councilor in Brampton, this is back in the 70s, who showed up for the meetings and carried in the envelope. It was this big, and we'd get to his table and rip open the envelope. It's still there? Oh, my God. That person was never prepared, and it was usually 2 minutes before the meeting started. That's disrespectful. It's disrespectful to people at this table, and it's disrespectful to staff and the public. You've been elected. You have a lot to read. This job, probably most of you had no idea how much reading you're going to do when you get elected to it, especially if you're an upper tier and lower tier. It's a lot to do. Be prepared. No micromanagement. Micromanagement can cause more problems in an organization than virtually any other. The other one, in my experience, is how meetings are conducted. But micromanagement can create huge difficulties. Stay out of the day-to-day operation. Approve the budget. Let them do their job. If you have questions about it, raise them with the CAO. Raise them at council if you need to. I assume you've all been trained on harassment and bullying policy. When did you do that? When you started? A long time ago. You should do it again. It's really important to keep current on that and to be reminded of it from time to time. And it's true for staff and it's true for you as members of council. And the last one is the same, respect for each other's roles. Why don't we take a break and I'll come back and talk a little bit about the public and how fundamentally matters come to council.
Thank you. So we'll take a break and we'll come back at 2:30. What I anticipated, so I'll turn it back over to you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
One last point on this slide that I just wanted to make is when we're talking about respect for each other's roles between staff and council, I think that's important. Staff needs to respect each other. The best conversation I had one time with one of the engineers at Sudbury, and we were doing some development work.
I was venturing into the world of being an engineer, which is pretty not very good. And he looked at me across the table and he said, let's make a deal. I said, what's that? He said, you be the lawyer and I'll be the engineer and we'll get along really well. And he was right. We spent 20 years working together and I never second-guessed his engineering and he's tried to stay out of the law, which nobody really can do because it's so much fun. You need to do that too. You've all been elected by the public, you need to respect the office. Doesn't mean you don't or won't disagree with each other. In fact, it'd be a pretty boring place if you didn't. But you need to do it with a level of respect. It shouldn't become personal. And I think in my world, that's really, really significant. Two fellows I knew in Sudbury on council who argued on lots of issues all the time. They were coming philosophically from different directions, but they were really good friends. At the end of the night, that was council, let's get back to it. You need to do that. As I say, you don't get to pick who you play with in the sandbox. It's really significant. Okay, let's talk about the public for a minute, because this becomes really significant in terms of how you're seen. Public's primary role when it comes to meetings or your role as being a public official is that they provide input to you. You'll get phone calls, emails, who knows, they'll run into you at the grocery store. You can never go shopping anymore without talking to people. It's just part of the way of life. So they're providing input to you all the time. But the issue is, how does the public participate in council meetings? One of the fundamental questions that I think is really important to answer for each of you is, whose meeting is it? Whose meeting is it? It's council meeting. It's your meeting. It's not the mayor's meeting. It's not staff's, the clerk's. It isn't the clerk's meeting. It's council's meeting. And it's not the public's meeting. That's really fundamental. You're a level of government, and you get to set the rules around how your meetings are conducted. That's fundamental. The courts have said consistently the primary purpose of public at council is to observe. The ability to watch. That's that public element of it. The ability to watch. The participation part for the public has to come through a process that is well-defined in your procedure bylaw, and we generally call that delegations. So people apply to speak to council. Why are they coming to council? To convince you of a point of view, to provide input and make recommendations on what they think is important. That's why they're there. They are not there to debate with you. In fact, my rule around delegations is, I always drafted the bylaws this way, and council agreed with it. The delegations were heard, but council did not do anything with respect to the request until later in the meeting, if at all, or maybe the next meeting when a report came back. But if it was going to be dealt with that night, it would not be dealt with immediately after the delegation. It would be dealt with. You want to create this opportunity to provide input, and then having the role that you are there to fulfill, which is the deliberations, the debate, and ultimately the vote. That's why it's there. So the public, it may not be an issue here, and I never asked the question, but there are some municipalities where council allows the public to participate in the meetings. And I've got so many examples, I don't know which ones to pick, but they are kind of a nightmare on wheels. They just, council loses control of the meeting, potentially it gets out of hand. And it's all because the council or the members of council believe that they have to hear from the public at the meeting itself on an informal basis. It doesn't work.
Just a question regarding your comment that you should not deal with the issue directly after they make their delegation. Is it not something that is considerate to the people who are delegating that you would stop and then go on and deal with four or five or six items and then come back to theirs? Wouldn't it be better from a public relations point of view to deal with everything at once?
It would make some sense, wouldn't it? Here's been my experience when you see that happen potentially is, particularly if it's a contentious issue, they will feel that they want to get back into the debate. They've just been given an opportunity to speak, and council will begin the deliberation, and they'll be back up on their feet trying to participate some more. You need to create a great divide. Same with planning issues. You should be moving from the planning process where you're having the hearing and create separately the decision-making part where you are deliberating the issue itself. There's no right and wrong answer. I understand your argument, and it's got lots of merit to it, because you don't want them to have to suffer through sitting the entire council meeting listening to some of the issues. I understand that. But if you had two or three delegations and you heard them, then you could deal with the matters arising from the delegations if you wanted to do it that way. But put some distance. I guess that's my point, a little bit of distance to make it clear to them that their role is now complete in providing advice and recommendations to council. Now you've taken over to have the deliberations and the vote.
And just a comment about the grocery store. My wife has a very clear definition. She says to people, I am not the conduit to the council.
Spouses are really, we just had this discussion. Spouses become really significant, or significant others become important in terms of your life at council. One of the things that your spew and I were just talking about this, not this last Roma Good Roads conference, but the one right after the election, Nigel Bellchamber and I offered to do, which we'd done for a couple of elections, a session for spouses at the conference, significant others. And they gave us a room that held about 75, 80 people, and we almost filled it. They gave us 45 minutes. And we came to the end, and if you're at a conference, you know they're on a really tight schedule time-wise, and they want to move things along. The people that were there were really engaged, and they were really interested. They wanted to hear, you know, what life was like being on council. And they were getting mad at us when we said, we have to end now. We can't stay any longer. I think that sort of training, and it's really, frankly, could be useful within the municipality to have the spouses come in and not sit with you necessarily, but just sit with someone that can talk about some of the realities of it, or have them come at a session like this and just be there. It's important to educate them. Sometimes we do a terrible job as municipalities educating people. We say we have to give orientation to council because you're really important. And then we forget about all the committee members. We're asking them to perform really significant roles. In some places, we put committees or boards together. And spouses, give them some background. Give them some help to understand what you do. One situation, one of the municipalities had a delay in the televising of their council meetings. And there was a 40-minute delay or 45-minute delay. And they would end their regular meeting and go into a closed session for something. And the council meeting, it worked in such a way that the wife said, "Where have you been all this time? I thought you were going to be home an hour ago." And they've, in fact, been in a closed meeting. So the more you can educate, the more you can educate around what confidentiality means. There's this wonderful story circulating right now. There was a closed meeting. Smaller community, member of council goes home. Pillow talk. Talks about what happened at the closed meeting. He goes off to work the next morning. The wife talks to the daughter. And the daughter goes to school and puts it on the internet, and the entire school knew all about it before noon. You need to maintain and understand confidentiality applies not only to the public generally, applies to your spouse and your children. It's the same, we're going to talk about closed meetings, but another example is some members of council insist on taking home the closed meeting documents you receive. And there are clerks around the province who just say, "You can't do that. I'm not letting you take that home." It's not the clerk's decision, frankly, but that's what they say. And what I say to them is, you should be telling your counselors this. Take it home. But you're now responsible for it. And by being responsible for it, you have to maintain it in a locked file cabinet that no access is given to anyone else, including your spouse or your children. And you have to keep it in perpetuity, which is quite a long time. You explain that to counselors on that basis, and they're happy to hand the materials back to you. You know, I don't want this. Because as long as you know that you can come in any day and see the clerk and take a look at the documents, why would you want to keep it? You know, so some really fundamental things about confidentiality and just this whole, you know, there should be a section in codes of conduct around pillow talk. It sounds kind of silly, but it's a fundamental in terms of you carry around with you some significant secrets in terms of this community. You need to protect them, both written documents, online, and in your head. You need to really be cautious. Okay. We've been using this chart for forever. We didn't design it. I think it came from Harvard Business School. Who identifies issues? Everybody does. You identify them, staff do, the public does, the media does. Anybody can identify an issue. But here's the key thing. Once an issue is identified, it needs to go to staff for a report. The Act says that. Staff provides advice and make recommendations. You as a council need to know and need that, in my opinion, protection that you are getting the advice of staff, that you're not running off in a direction that could give you some difficulties. So that's the second step. Whatever the source of the idea has to have a staff report. Council makes the decision. That's your responsibility. Staff have to implement that. We've talked about it. And staff have to measure its effectiveness, and at the end of the day, on a number of issues, you have to evaluate the effectiveness of your decision. That's a really good chart, and it's really useful, and it's useful for you politically. If you're talking to people about what the process is at the town hall, there it is. You can take them through the process, and it's really simple to read. Really, really useful, so I encourage you to keep this one around. Osborne and Gabler wrote a book, I think it was the 70s, but it may have been in the 80s, called Reinventing Government. Council should steer the boat rather than row it. You decide the services and leave the how-to to staff. And I think that's still a good message today. I think it's really, really useful. So here are some of the things we've talked about and where we're going to go. Council exercises power. That's Section 5 of the Municipal Act, and they do so by bylaw, which means at a public meeting. beware of micromanaging. Just as staff, frankly, need to be aware of being ahead of counsel in terms of getting out to the public and what position should be taken. I'm a big fan of staff not being in the media, certainly on anything that's coming to you for a decision. That's your job. I leave it to you. Your unique role, Your Worship, is head of counsel. Some of those, it's a very different chair and some of those responsibilities. Personal conduct of members of council gets dealt with in one of two ways. At meetings, it gets dealt with in your procedure bylaw, and outside of meetings, it's your code of conduct. And they should be, I assume they are here, I haven't looked, but they're two separate documents as far as I know, and that's the way they should be. But they are the documents that are dealing with your personal conduct. Keep in mind that every elected official that I've ever been aware of that's gotten into serious difficulty, what do they get in trouble over? They get in trouble over ethical issues, over conduct issues. Not that you didn't work quite hard enough, but over ethical issues. And that's really significant, I think, at the end of the day. I want to mention being on a local board or upper tier. This has created some confusion in some people. I haven't heard it this term, but certainly other terms, where the question is, can this council direct, how many of you are on regional council? One, two, three, four. Could this council pass a resolution directing you how to vote at the region? What do you think? We expect you to vote. Take this with me. We expect you to vote this way on this issue when it gets upstairs. Is that binding? No, it's not. Council can suggest that it'd be appropriate for you to, but when you move to the upper tier or to the library board or to the health unit or whatever, you put on a different hat. You're now a regional councillor. And what are the duties that you owe as a regional councillor? They're exactly the same as we went through. Region's a municipality. So you owe a duty to that corporation, to the municipality at large, to all of those fundamentals that we talked about with you. You are put there. Generally speaking, people at upper tier councils are ex officio to the upper tier, but you're there by virtue of your office. You are there and you are expected to bring your best judgment. And there are times when, frankly, you're going to make decisions that are in the best interests of the region that may not be in the best interests of the lower tier. If you're looking at a series of projects, for example, and there may be, you may be two, and number two and three are in debate, and it may be clear at the end of the day that the other area of the region needs the work first. That's the hat you're wearing. And it's really fundamental. There was one council north of here three years ago, where the person on the county was told, you have to vote this way, and when she didn't do it, she was removed from committees, her remuneration was slashed, they did all sorts of things that were completely inappropriate, and they simply misunderstood her role being at the upper tier and being at this tier. When you sit at this table, you act in the best interest of this organization. When you sit at the region, same deal. And it may, from time to time, be different. You may sit on a library board, and you'll make a decision at the library board to do something, but when it gets to this council, you're looking at the library in the context of all the services the municipality provides, and you may look at it differently. So, really fundamental. It's not an issue most places, but it comes up from time to time. This is a really inadequate summary of accountable and transparent, but I wanted to mention the importance of the policy, the fact that it really can assist you to help you understand how you're being accountable as an organization and transparent. Accountability goes to, and transparency, duly constituted meetings, you're making decisions in public, you're having the debate. MFIPA is freedom of information, the request for records from the municipality. That's an accountability issue. People can see the documents. Your code of conduct. where you put a code in place, it's council passes it, the code is a bylaw of council. You may appoint, in fact, you will appoint an integrity commissioner who will investigate complaints under it and report to council. Integrity commissioners do not impose penalties. Council imposes the penalty. Integrity commissioner recommends.
Did I miss it? A&T policy.
Accountability and transparency policy.
Okay.
Every municipality in the province has to have one. It should be no more than 3 pages. And a number of the municipalities I work with, they carry that. Councillors carry it to every meeting. Hard copy of it. It's really a valuable document. The other, and probably the best, most transparent method is the issue of open meetings, the ability of the public to see your meetings, the ability of the public to be told in advance that you're having them. Really, really fundamental. I'd like to go through the closed meeting rules very quickly. I think they're important. The good news I got from your staff is this council's pretty good around closed meetings. But even having said that, I'm going to tell you about it anyway, so it's worth hearing it. I'm astounded. I get emails from people all the time. I got two this week from clerks, actually, having a complete misunderstanding that you can vote at closed meetings. They haven't allowed them at their council. These are small places, but they haven't allowed them. So it's worth going over the rules once in a while. Closed meeting rules are set out in Section 239 of the Municipal Act. It's interesting, I've been doing some work with an agency with the City of Toronto recently. Toronto rules are exactly the same as yours. The section number in their act's different, but the rules are exactly the same. They're under the same regime. So you have a limited ability to hold closed meetings, and you must do so in compliance with the legislation, and you are now subject to investigation and review by a closed meeting investigator, and I need to tell you up front, that's what I do. I'm part of Amber LeGavel, and we do closed meeting investigations on behalf of LAS and AMO, 140-some clients. So I see a lot of this, spend a lot of time doing it. The starting principle in the Act, and it's really got to be the starting principle in your head and in staff's head. Everything is public. Unless it fits within a limited number of reasons. And all of these reasons, with one exception, are may, not shall. They're discretionary, not mandatory. That's important to keep in mind as well. Sometimes staff tend to put more in clothes than there absolutely needs to be there. Not always, but occasionally. And that's, in my experience, they're trying to protect you. But there may be reason to not have to do that.
Thank you, Fred. Anybody here in council knows I'm kind of a stickler on the word may. And it's something that's bothered me when I was a resident, looking up what was allowed and what wasn't allowed, and the simple word that says may. There are a lot of words within legislation that are very loose with regards to, or may, as opposed to must. So here I am again, and I have to say our clerk does a great job at going by what's allowed under 239, but it's always may. We're able to do it, but my question still as a councillor, and I can't change my position from when I was a resident looking at it, is that may, even though you're allowed to do it, doesn't mean you always should do it. And I would love for the legislation to be cleaned up to actually really create definite parameters about what shall be done and what may be done, because so often we go in camera and it's under may. And I find that what happens is the discussion happens there and it doesn't happen in council. And I just think we do a disservice to the people who actually want to understand the issue. And even for me, I have to say sometimes I get confused at what was in camera and what was out of camera, because so much gets said in there and then some gets said out here, and you're going, okay, which was it? Was it in camera or was it out of camera? But it's this darn word may that I have an exception to. So I love your comments. And I don't know who changes that word.
Well, I don't think you want to change the words. I'm going to disagree with you a bit.
And that's good.
The first word you need to take out of your vocabulary is must. The acts use the word, and bylaws tend to use the word shall. And that becomes that's the must word, if you will, but that's the word you'll see in legislation. You shall do it. And that, if it's shall, that's mandatory. You have to do it. The reason it's may for most of these, virtually all of them in the list we're going to come to in a minute, there's one in there that talks about a personal matter about an identifiable individual, okay? Let's suppose you won Counselor of the Year for Canada, awarded by whomever. To acknowledge that award is a personal matter about an identifiable individual. Council could do that at a closed meeting. Would you want to? Well, of course not. You want to tell the world that you just won this award. Council wants to do that. So you're taking a subject matter that may be appropriate in one, I'm using may, may be appropriate in one circumstance, but not in another. You may be at the end of a real estate transaction where you're now, you're now going ahead with the bylaw to purchase the property. You don't need to go into the closed meeting. The problem when you try and make it absolutely mandatory is you might put handcuffs on yourself that are just too hard to work around. May requires discretion. The discretion starts with your staff, because they will sit around management team or whatever, my guess, I haven't talked to them, but I know how we did it. And we would say which ones go into the closed meeting and which ones don't. And we would make that determination when we put the agenda together, okay? But here's what happened occasionally at a council meeting. Put up your hand and say, Your Worship, do we have to do the second item, a closed meeting item in the closed meeting? Can we do it in public? And the mayor would ask council, do we need to go into close for this? And councilors would say, no, we're all good. And they just carried on with the public meeting. On the other hand, partway through a meeting, something might come up and a councilor may say, I have one issue around HR, a question that really affects staffing. Could we get that question answered at a closed meeting? And council would immediately move into a closed meeting, ask the question, get the answer, and come back out and continue the debate. You can do that. May, you're right, May has discretion painted all over it. And discretion starts with staff and it ends with you. At the end of the day, it's council that makes the determination whether it stays there or not. Staff is merely making the recommendation to you how to do it. That doesn't help you at all, but it sort of...
No, I appreciate it. So now I ask a question of staff. Is that what happens, SMT? Does that SMT make that decision what goes in camera or suggested to go in camera? Because I know council makes that final decision. I guess that's Mr. CAO over there. Is that what happens? I don't know. Nobody's ever told me.
Well, first of all, the items are discussed, obviously, at SMT as we're developing the report. But ultimately, the recommendation is always with the clerk's office to identify whether the information may be relevant to an in-camera session or not. But you will know also that before you go in-camera, you do have a vote to accept the information to go into that forum. So it's a bit of a multi-pronged approach.
Yeah, that's good. All right. I want to describe closed meeting procedures with three elements to it. And if you kind of get these three elements, it becomes a little easier to understand. The first is the reason for going into the closed meeting. The second is how do you get into a closed meeting? And the third, what can you do when you get there? And if you kind of break it down into these component parts, it becomes a lot more logical, if you will, a lot easier to comprehend. Reasons, how you get in, what you can do once you're in there. We'll go through each of those quickly. The closed meeting rules apply to council. They apply to your committees, and they may apply just to some of your committees. You just change your committee structure, as I understand. You've gone committee of the whole? Okay, it applies to committee of the whole. And it applies to some of your local boards. Same rules apply. Library Board, for example, has exactly the same rules with one exception, two exceptions actually, but basically it's the same set of rules. You have to look at each piece of legislation that creates a local body to see what the rules are around closed meetings. Okay, so let's start through with number one, which is the reasons. This is the list, the summary of the reasons. Security of property, that's not merely the lock on the door. That's all the security of all the intellectual property that you have, any property or any investment that you have in land, buildings, whatever. You're entitled to go into a closed meeting to receive information or to give direction to staff. You're able to do that. That makes sense. Personal matter about an identifiable individual. The media still to this day, back in the 90s and pre-90s, it used to be personnel matter. That's what it said. And they still interpret this to be personnel matter. It's not. It's way broader than that. It's your winning the award. Two things are key. Personal, it's not about business or corporations. Identifiable individual is not corporations, it's individuals. It makes sense to be able to go into a closed meeting to deal with acquisition or disposition of land and property. I mean, if you're going to give the CAO direction to go negotiate for a piece of property, you kind of lose your negotiating advantage if you have to do that in a public way. You want to be able to do it at a closed meeting. And you need to be specific on that. If you're giving the CAO direction to go negotiate the corner of walk and don't walk, make it clear. It's for an upset limit of $100,000 and whatever other conditions you want. And they need to be written in the motion that's presented. Labor relations or employee negotiations, again, that makes sense that that be in a closed meeting because you're dealing with confidential information. Litigation's an interesting one. A couple of points of view. Litigation is defined in this legislation not only to include the traditional definition of court actions, it also includes administrative tribunals. So if you have an upcoming OMB hearing, for example, you're entitled to go into a closed meeting to get advice from your solicitor or planner to provide direction to them. Potential litigation means real potential. I've heard counselors say to me, Fred, this is a dangerous business we're in. We could get sued on everything we do. You need to be cautious. Well, you need real potential means you've been threatened. You may have a lawsuit threatened in writing. It's not something theoretical down the road. Be cautious about that. There's a special relationship between lawyers and clients. And it's referred to as a lawyer is able to provide advice under what is called a solicitor-client privilege. Who holds the privilege? Who holds the privilege in solicitor-client privilege? It's not a trick question. What do you think? Joanna, what do you think? The client. It's the client's privilege, and the client is counsel. So counsel holds the privilege. The lawyer doesn't. So if you tell a lawyer something in confidence at a closed meeting, that stays confidential forever until you agree to release it. If you're receiving advice from a solicitor, what's the best way to receive it? What do you think? Listen to it. That's right. Have them standing here talking to you, answering the questions that you have so that it's clear to everyone. The other good way to receive it is to have it in writing. The very best is to have it in writing and have the person here. Here's what you shouldn't do. You shouldn't have the lawyer talk to the CAO or the clerk in the afternoon and then come to a closed meeting going in there's under solicitor-client privilege and the clerk or CAO saying, here's what the lawyer told me, here's the lawyer's advice. That's hearsay. We've all played the game where I whisper in the mayor's ear and it goes around the room and it comes out over here sounding a whole lot different. Be really cautious. The privilege only extends to clients and their lawyers. That's either in writing or it's having the person in front of you. Don't put it through a mediary. Can't do it. The other way you can do it is have the lawyer on a conference call. You can do that. You're entitled. I give advice to municipalities in the north quite often because they don't want me to spend $2,000 on airfare on Bearskin Airlines. You can do that. But make sure that you're getting the advice and it will be protected if you go in under this section.
Sorry. Okay. So I get about advice that is solicitor client privilege. I totally understand that. I totally understand litigation. My concern, once again, falls back on that word, potential litigation. And as a resident prior to coming to council, that word bothered me. I hear it all the time from my residents who say, well, if potential is in there, then you as a municipality could actually overuse that because anything could be potential litigation. So is that a defined term under legislation of any? No. It's one of those loosey-goosey words.
I can tell you in my entire career, I never went in under that section to counsel unless I had a threat from a lawyer or an individual threatening lawsuit. That was the only trigger for me as the solicitor for the city.
But I think it always comes up, and I may be wrong, but I think on ours it always comes up as litigation or potential litigation as a whole term. I don't think
it's
we
ever...
It's
because it's the section, subsection in the Act. It's just the way it's... I mean, if you can break it out. If it's litigation, just say litigation. Forget the potential part. And if it is potential, say potential litigation. You can do that.
Okay.
One of the things, there are two decisions of the court in 2007. One's out of Kingston and one's out of London. One, the London case is Supreme Court of Canada, and the Kingston case is the Court of Appeal. So pretty substantial courts in terms of, they provided the best advice to us in terms of closed meetings that we could have possibly had going into 2008 in the investigations. And in the Kingston case, the court said, you're entitled to protect everything that's on that list, but you need to tell as much as you can without detrimentally impacting the municipality. So if it's potential litigation, you may not want anyone to know at this point. You may want to keep it from the public. But let's take the circumstance where in a month from now we have an OMB hearing coming up, and staff wants to go in because the planner or the lawyer wants to get some direction on one aspect. What harm is it in telling the public that council's going in to, with respect to the potential, to the upcoming OMB hearing? So what? I mean, you're not breaking any secrets by saying we're going in for that. You're not telling them what the rationale is in terms of what information. There's no detrimental impact. So what the court says, tell as much as you can without detrimentally impacting. You're right. It's a bit of a judgment call. It's this May thing all over again in some respects, absolutely. But if you've got a concern about litigation or potential litigation, just make it litigation, unless it is potential. I would have no trouble with that. Right. I said that the mayor and the issue of around chief executive officer was the big deal in 2005. There were two of them. This was the other one. The issue was, should council be allowed to go into and be trained, have training behind closed doors? And the province said, interestingly, yes, you can. In fact, when this went in Bill 130, all that existed was the first bullet point, the may be closed for the purpose of education and training. And it got to third reading at the province, and the committee said, whoa, that's such a big hole, we could drive anything through that. That's not going to work. So they added the second part to it. And that is that no member, that's you, discusses or deals with a matter in a way that materially advances the business or decision making. You need to be really cautious about training behind closed doors because you can't get into the real substance of some issues. You ask the person training you, well, where should we go on this file? Should we be doing this or this or this? And I'll never vote for that part. You've just materially advanced the business. So you need to be really cautious about... I did probably 50 orientations after the last election, municipalities around the province, only one was closed. You were open here, and I commend you for that. I think that's really good. It's really, really positive. And I told that group that day, the message is no different, but frankly, you can't get into specifics with me because you might be materially advancing the business. And I'm really cautious about it because I do closed-meeting investigations. So. The other thing this made clear is that having training internally is a meeting. That was never clear. A lot of people thought, no, coming to training session isn't a meeting. Province has now made it absolutely clear that it is. You can go into under the Emergency Management Act for certain parts. And in fact, part of that is shall. You must go in for certain parts. Are you the head for MFIPA? MFIPA doesn't apply to you. It applies to councils who have not taken the step of delegating all the powers to the clerk to decide which documents go out. That's insane. Any council that does that, that's really a mistake. In my opinion, it doesn't work. The brand new one that came in on January 1st, if there's an ongoing investigation by the ombudsman or a closed meeting investigator, you can receive the report and review it and comment back to them at a through a closed meeting. That wasn't there before. It makes some sense. Understand at the end of the day, though, that that report will still be made public when it's finalized. It will still be made. But it gives you one more opportunity for closed. That's the list. There are no other reasons to go into a closed meeting. So when we talk about a restricted list, it really is a restricted list. So part two of this exercise is what do you have to do before you go into a closed meeting? And the Act says you must pass a resolution. And you have to pass it at a public meeting. It can be the same meeting that you're holding the closed meeting at, or it can be a meeting before. And you could say, we're going to hold a closed meeting on this day for this purpose. And you can do that if you wish. It doesn't happen very often. The resolution has to do two things. Has to acknowledge that you're holding a closed meeting. That's your transparency and your accountability part again. And it has to state the general nature of the matter or matters to be considered. You can put more than one item on a closed meeting agenda, but they have to be listed in the resolution. Here's the key. You can't talk about anything else. No other deliberations. And I assume that your clerk is fanatic about this. Good clerks are. They need to tell you, you can't do that. Stop now. Even if it's a permitted subject matter, if it's not in this resolution, you can't do it. Really critical. So before the meeting, two facts. Facts you're holding it and the general nature of the matter or matters. The third item is votes. What can you do at a closed meeting? Well, the Act says you can have three types of votes. You can have procedural votes, adjournment, my favorite, or give direction. Direct the CAO to negotiate the corner of walk and don't walk. That's it. Notice it doesn't include straw votes or consensus. They're not there. I think it's always critical to have motions that are presented at a closed meeting be in writing. And they be detailed and deliberate, clear, so that the CAO, when he goes away to negotiate, knows exactly what he has to negotiate. There used to be people who would draft these motions, this is years ago, who would make them so vague because they thought they were going to be out in the public. So it would be something like the CAO's authorized and directed to go negotiate a piece of property as outlined in a report. Well, that doesn't do you any good. Be specific about it. They need to be in writing. The reason you want them in writing is you want to be clear what direction you're giving them, but so does he. He needs to understand. Back in the 80s, there was none of this. And council would meet in closed sessions. There were no minutes. The clerk and I would sit down the day after the meeting and we'd get to the close part and we'd say, what did they tell us to do? And if you've been debating for 40 minutes on whether it's 100,000 or 105 or 103 or 108 or 92, and you come out saying, I'm not sure where they landed, so it really became difficult for us as staff and frankly, From time to time, we made it up. We guessed. We think that's what you wanted us to do, but we weren't inside. You don't want to do that. Have it in writing. Make it absolutely clear. Written resolutions are really helpful. In terms of investigations, any person can make a request. It can be a former member of council, former member of staff, current member of council. It can be the media. It can be a ratepayer. It can be somebody living in Hong Kong. It doesn't matter. Any person, and that includes corporations, by the way, so it can be the media. We have seen all those, except the Hong Kong one. But we've seen out-of-jurisdiction ones. We've done a few of those. If you have a closed meeting investigator, that's who investigates. If by default, it's the provincial ombudsman. And I mentioned that I'm involved with Amberley Gavel. Well, by the way, on Amberley Gavel, you can see all the reports that we've written since 2008. So if you're having trouble sleeping any night and you need some light reading or not, they're all there. So you get a bit of the rationale. Municipal government, yes?
Just following up on your last slide, Fred, where you talked about an investigation. What would be the authority of that investigation as a result? Is it just that if it failed to meet the test of a closed meeting, that would have to get pulled into open session? Or what powers and authorities would you be able to exert as a result of your investigation?
I don't have any powers. I love my life. Why do you think people put in a request for an investigation? What's their driving force? Well, I'll tell you, they don't like the decision you made. So, you know, I'm going to get even with counsel. I'm going to file a request to have that decision investigated. They're always disappointed because that's not what we do. The investigation simply looks at the three things we've talked about: proper reason, did you go in properly, what actions did you take at the closed meeting, and you apply Section 239 to everything you did, and you apply your own procedure bylaw to see if you complied with it. So was the meeting properly called, all that sort of thing. That's it. So we'll do an investigation, and they can vary between sitting down, interviewing everybody that was there, to having two phone calls with a couple of people, depending on the complexity of it. We always start in one place. Where do you think that is? The clerk. We always talk to the clerk first. And if we're talking to a number of people, we're, as any investigation, looking for inconsistencies. If you tell us different things. At the end of the day, the result is a report that's prepared. It gets sent to the municipality, to the council, and now you can go into close to take a look at it first, but at the end of the process, you have to put it out publicly, which in our world means you put it on an agenda, post it on your website. That's it. There's no other penalty involved. The provincial ombudsman would like you to go to jail. At least that's what I understand, that the former one and the current one saying there should be a serious penalty for any member of council breaching these rules. I don't think that's appropriate. I think telling the community is an appropriate signal in terms of how you've been conducting yourselves. And so I'm not a big fan of introducing serious penalties around this. Is that helpful? Okay. Very quickly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but council makes decisions. We've talked about the primary role of staff as being making recommendations, providing background and making recommendations. When you create committees, that's exactly why you create committees, is to provide council with advice and make recommendations, give assistance, let the committees do some background. When you create committees, they are mandated by council. Council sets the mandate, council sets the reporting authority, you'll set membership, you do all those things. Committees don't go off on their own and create their own mandate. Council does that for them. It's important to do. We've talked about local boards. They are separate entities in law. They have separate responsibilities, and each one is responsible under a specific statute. So there's a Public Libraries Act, Public Health Act, and all those. And you have to be looking at what those that legislative requirement is in each case to see what the relationship is. You fund some of them, many of them, but you do the funding in very different ways for very different local boards. Okay. If you are new to council, you've discovered by now there are a lot of meetings. It takes a lot of your life, and so you need to get good at it. And if you're not good at it, you're going to get really frustrated around this table, and I've said that for years. Key document is procedure bylaw. I think along with the annual budget, I have to be careful with the financial people sitting right behind. It's one of the two most important documents in the municipality, the other being your annual budget. It sets your priorities for the year. Your procedure bylaw sets your relationship, how you conduct yourself at council, what's your relationship with each other, with the head of council, with you and staff, and with the public. It's a really critical document, and it drives the process. And really good bylaws take a lot of the conflict, in my experience, out of council meetings. We'll talk in a few minutes about trust, and I'll talk about how you develop some of that trust and how you can create distrust pretty quickly. Governance models, you've just changed your governance model going to a committee of the whole system, and that's a legitimate process, and I think it's good that you've changed and at least examined your governance model in terms of how you're doing it. You need to do an assessment of it about a year out to see how effective it's been, if it's been useful. Is it taking more time or less of your time? The one issue around committee as a whole that you have to be cautious around is it has an element of it of sober second thought. And the question always is, how much sober second thought do you need? You know, 95% of all the items that go through committee of the whole to council don't get deliberated again, they just get passed through. So how much sober second thought is important? So, but I commend you for doing that review. At meetings, the person that's probably the expert on procedure, excuse me, is the clerk. I expect the head of council to be in that expert category as well. Clerk's there to provide you advice, not to make decisions. Don't ask the clerk to decide how an issue should be decided. Clerk's there to provide advice to the council. Really fundamental. So you create committees to provide advice. Do you need all the committees? This is something in some municipalities becomes a huge issue. I think I mentioned at one point in Sudbury we had 54, I think. Council shrunk the list a bit, but couldn't answer. The test was, were they being effective? So it defines relationships. I think that's a really key element of it. It really makes a difference in terms of your relationship with the public and staff. With respect to the public, if you have rules for delegations, which you will have in your procedure bylaw, I recommend that you take those rules and write them in simple English. Don't get trapped in the legalese that clerks and lawyers tend to write in. Write it in simple English. So you want to come and appear before council, here's what you need to know. Post it in your office here, post it on your website. So it's really easy. I never, never get upset at delegations who don't know what the rules are if they haven't been told properly. Tell them the rules, most people will respect that. Most people who come as delegations, not the professional people, but just ratepayers who want to come and talk to their council, are terrified standing here. This is a really intimidating place for some people. Respect that. Help them through the process. And staff generally are good, but if they can read something really simple, it really, really helps. Congratulations on updating. I really mean it. That's really significant. So I've asked the question before, whose meeting is it? It's yours. It's council meeting. That's really important. It's not just the mayor's. It's not anyone else's. It's council as a whole. You making decisions as a majority. Some of you will have heard me talk about this as the ambush, where council allows itself to be ambushed from various directions. And I think it's really, really important to understand the impact that that can have on your council. Here's my test. When I walk into the council chamber, whether I'm a member of council or staff or the public, I should know with certainty what items you're going to deal with tonight. I don't think that's a difficult concept. You know, you've told the public probably 3 or 4 days ahead, here's the agenda for tonight. And if you do anything to change that, you've suddenly created a potential for distrust. You'll stop liking each other. You'll wonder what staff's doing. And the public start to beat up on you in a really, really not very pleasant way. So let's go through them quickly. Members of council should not be able to add new items to an agenda to be dealt with tonight. If you do that, that can be a bit of an ambush, because if you didn't know what was coming from across the room, it's a really uneasy feeling. So how do you do that? Well, you do something called, it's called traditionally notices of motion, where you file it tonight. It gets read at the meeting, and then it gets put on the next agenda. What happens with it? Goes to staff. Staff can prepare a report if it's appropriate, and it comes back. So the public now knows, every member of council knows, and the staff knows. That takes the level of trust, in my experience, to a much higher level. Everyone knows what's coming at them.
Okay. I totally agree with you.
Ooh, there's a first.
We've had a few meetings together. My concern is, I was part of helping to rewrite the procedural bylaw, which was a fabulous experience, I have to say. But the one item that came up and that we couldn't find a good definition for was an urgent. And it's come before council a couple times, and what is urgent? And my worry is exactly what you said. The people are going to mistrust. They think, it's come forward, and I didn't know it was coming forward as a council member. So I've had a problem with it. So trying to find a definition of what is urgent, that it didn't need a notice of motion, is something that we struggled to define, and therefore we didn't define it. I still think it needs to be defined, but that's just me. Don't know what your experience has been through time with urgent motions. Love to hear.
It depends, I suppose, how many really silly things you've seen brought up at council at the last minute over the years. And I've seen some councillors who try to railroad all sorts of things through, and it's really inappropriate. I don't like the word urgent, because urgent could be, well, one of the department heads just couldn't get the report done on time, and so it's urgent that council deal with it this week, so we'll deal in it with an addendum. Is that urgent? Not in my world. If department heads are not, if a department head is not meeting the agenda goals, thank you. That's a performance appraisal issue, frankly. That's a performance issue, flat out. The word I like better than urgent is emergency. And I've seen some bylaws recently where they define it in terms of an emergency under the emergency plan. So if one of your bridges collapses or whatever, major snowstorm or whatever. So that's one way of packaging it, is to use that definition. And I don't think that's a particularly bad one. I think it's got some value to it. I'm happier the more narrow you make that definition than broad. But I think there's another distinction that you can make that really is helpful too. A lot of municipalities, I should have looked at your bylaw before I got here. A lot of municipalities have an item called new business, which is, I'll just throw anything I want on tonight's meeting. Bad news. I mean, that just encourages you to distrust. Here's how I define new items when I do a bylaw now. I say it has two parts to it. First is a notice of motion by a member of council. And the second is community announcements. So you may go around the room and say, in my ward in the last couple of weeks, we had a party for Mrs. Jones who turned 100 again, or whatever it might be. Or, you know, there's a fundraiser, or there's this public meeting coming up. Sort of good news stories, if you will, or just events that are happening. And that becomes the second part of new business. Nothing to be done on it, simply telling council what some of your public role within your particular community is. Really helpful. It's really important to do that. But that's how I define new business. Because I keep going back to this, when I walk in the room, I should know what you're going to deal with tonight. So emergency is, in my view, a better definition. You may want to broaden it out slightly from your emergency plan. Be really cautious about staff who are not hitting agenda times, particularly if it's one person over and over. That's a performance issue. That's really important to do. So I start with the basic principle that I want to be fair to everybody in the community. The third way you can be ambushed is by the public. If you allow them to come and just talk at the meetings and take you off in different directions, that's an ambush too. And they can take you down roads. You know, they can raise things at council that you had no intention of ever dealing with tonight. And frankly, they can make you look pretty bad. I was talking to a counselor recently who said, it's okay, Fred, we put the people that come and just make comments, we put them at the end of the meeting, sort of when the meeting's coming to an end, and that's a good time to have them come. And I said, so the reality is they're being invited to tell you just how stupid council was. And they stopped and looked and said, well, yeah, I guess that's what they do. They come up and bluster about the decision council just made. That's not doing you any good at all. It really is impacting. If you allow them to come forward and speak on anything they want, they can steal your meeting. And they can steal your headline in the newspaper or on the media the next day. And you might have done 10 really good things, and suddenly they've taken it right away from you. They've made some suggestion. When Nigel and I do work together, he talks about money missing at the arena and then disappears. And that becomes the headline in the newspaper, potentially, that council was no idea that there was money missing at the arena. You need to really be cautious. So when I talk about a matter of trust, when I talk about having agendas, when you put agendas out to the public, you put them on the internet, you are saying to the public, here's what we're going to do next week. Come on along if you'd like to join us, or watch it on TV, or do whatever you want. But you can't say, we're putting this up, and oh, by the way, we'll throw a few other things on as we feel like it, either from staff or from ourselves. I don't think you're being fair. And I feel really strongly about this, because I see more. I'm doing this next week. I'm spending 2 days with a council, one-on-one interviews, and they are just ambushing each other every single council meeting. It's a mess. And they're not being fair to anybody, themselves, the public, or staff. And take that principle of walking into the room. I think it really makes some sense. All right. Okay. Minutes. Clerk's favorite topic. Remember I said that the clerk is a statutory officer, has a job description given to by the province? Well, they do. Clerk is responsible to record the proceedings, that is, take the minutes of the meeting. And the Act has told the clerk how to do those. And the Act contains the words, the clerk shall record the proceedings without note or comment. The minutes are not the Reader's Digest version of what happened at the meeting. I've seen counselors over the year come rushing up to the clerk and say, you got to put in every word I said tonight. It was pure gold. I was brilliant. And the clerk needs to say, no. That's not going in the minutes. It's the corporate record. That's why the taping or the podcasting or whatever becomes really useful. They are not the corporate record. They're not the minutes, because the minutes have to meet the statutory test. Don't ever say to a clerk, you need to say right in there what I said tonight, because the clerk has a duty under the Act not to do that. I mean, there are two extremes, aren't there? The one extreme is without note or comment, and the other is called Hansard, where you record every single word spoken, and you type it all out. And that's not where we are in local government in Ontario. So, and I wasn't asked to say this by the clerk, by the way. Okay, just very quickly, I'm not going to spend long on this. There are some provincially imposed rules. And this is important. I've had people say to me, well, all you need is Robert's Rules of Order. Well, that's wrong. This is really a different world than what Roberts contemplates or what Bourineau or Duchesne contemplate. You have to have a procedure bylaw. You have to give notice to the public. How you vote is all set out in the Municipal Act. You know, the tie votes, the abstentions, the recorded votes, all of those are set out in the Act. You have a test for quorum. You can't change that test. It's set in the Act. You're required. The head has the power to expel people from the council chamber during a meeting. It's in the Act. You can put it in your bylaw, and in fact, you can have council exercise the same power by resolution, but the power in the Act exists for the mayor to do that. These are all provincial. Conflict of Interest Act sets out the quorum requirements, talks about the five declarations and the five statutory duties. Again, they're different in your type of meeting than they are in any other type of meeting. Concrete. This is concrete. Okay, you can't change any of this. You can't say, well, gee, quorum for us would be good if it were 3 or 2 or 9. The Act says it's a majority of council. We can't do votes differently than what the Act sets out. The Act sets these certain hard and fast rules that you have to follow. You then create the rules for your council chamber around those, and you'll create what's appropriate conduct, you'll create the flow of business, what various items mean. We've been talking about that today. So they both impact on your process. Every procedure bylaw has to recognize and take into account the provincial rules. 239, the closed meeting rules. You can't make up new reasons, for example, to go into a closed meeting. Province has said that's what they are. By the way, if you haven't amended your procedure bylaw to pick up the new one, you should do that really soon. Important to do. Actually, you don't have to. If your bylaw is drafted right, you don't have to do that. If you're parroting, you have to do it. If you're not, okay. So the answer is you get to write the rules for yourself, but they are subject to some provisos as set out in the Municipal Act. Okay, this is just observations. I think everybody that comes into this chamber needs to be prepared. You need to know what's on tonight's agenda. You need to know the main issues. I think the clerk and the mayor and the CAO need to talk about the hot button issues that are coming forward. You need to have a sense of the flow of the meeting. It's really important. The most effective counselor, did I tell you about Mr. Dow? Did I ever tell you about Mr. Dow? Can I take 2 minutes and tell you? Dick Dow, Richard Dow, was the mayor of Coppercliff forever. And in 1973, Sudbury was created, the city of Sudbury was created as part of regional government and was expanded to take in a whole big area, including Coppercliff, and he became the councillor for Ward 8. And at that point, he attended council. The council was 10 people. And Mr. Dow, he's the only person I've ever met in this business who was always Mr. He garnered that respect from day one. He would speak at a council meeting perhaps twice at every meeting, rarely three times. But when he spoke, what was the old saying? When E.F. Hutton spoke, people listened. When Mr. Dow spoke, people listened. He was prepared. He had a couple of bullet points. He never spoke for more than 3 minutes. He was the leader of council. he asked questions of staff that were the most difficult questions I ever had to deal with in my career. He was brilliant. He was really, really smart. My point, though, is this, and I'll tell you the end of the story in a minute. You don't have to speak on every issue to be impressive. You have to really pick and choose what you want to speak on. You have to think about how you're going to prepare your comments, and you have to deliver them effectively. It's a pretty powerful message. I mean, speaking on every issue, you lose impact. You don't gain it, in my experience. Dick Dow became ill. At this point, he was in his late 70s, and he became quite ill. And he wasn't going to be able to be at council for quite some time. And in fact, after 2 months, I called his wife and said, does he want to stay on council? Because you've got that magic three-month time period. If you aren't at meetings for 3 months, you're automatically off council. And she said, yes, he'd like to, but it's probably going to be another month or so. I did a report to council, and it was the most extraordinary night, maybe with the exception of the Ozzy Osbourne concert. It was the most exceptional night I ever saw. The motion was put to extend the time, the 3 months to, I think it was 4 or 5 months. Every member of council that night spoke, and every one of them said the same thing, that the residents of Ward 8, Coppercliff, have representation, and they would cover every concern and complaint that came along. It was an extraordinary thing to see. I'd never watched anything. And it was simply from the respect that he had garnered over many, many years in local government. We had to bring the motion one more time, and he did get back to council for a while and didn't run in the next election. But he taught so many powerful lessons. Good questions, don't say a lot unless you absolutely have to, and make what you say really mean something. You're here as leaders, and I expect, frankly, leaders to think about what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. It's really important. Okay, oh, I put Dick Dow. I forgot about that. Okay, ask questions in advance. We talked about that. Council speaks by resolution. Council speaks. You can either do a resolution, or which is a motion when it comes here and gets deliberated, and when it's passed, it becomes a resolution, or it speaks by bylaw. Council, and I've made the mistake today a lot, but council is an it. It's not a they. You are an it. You are a body. It's like parliament is it. So council is an it, and that's how I should be referring to you. I've talked about the majority prevailing. That's really fundamental, so you need to be working with your colleagues and with staff to make sure you get that. Codes of conduct, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. You have one. I mentioned before the integrity commissioner does the report. You determine the take the report and determine if the penalty is appropriate or if there should be some sanction. Penalties are not that substantial under the code of conduct. A reprimand or not loss of 90 days remuneration, which probably won't change your lifestyle a lot, may in some communities, but most communities it's not. But that's the penalty at this point, other than the community being aware of it. Bill 8's now in effect. We still have to see some of the regulations. There's going to be municipal ombudsman, which my guess is it's going to be the provincial one for most people. Provincial ombudsman has some oversight now, not around closed meetings, but around integrity commissioners. And we'll have to see with the new ombudsman how that's going to play out. Time will tell. I don't know why I'm talking to you about training. You're obviously, it's important to you, and I commend you for that. I think training of staff and training of yourselves, and as I said before, of your committees and local boards is really important. This is complex business. It's technical. Give yourself every advantage you can. Get good not just at the hard subjects that you deal with, but at the things like how to be effective at meetings, how to make things happen. I think that's really important training, some of the basics. Staff need to have training in their technical areas, but staff also need training in report writing, because you need to ensure that they are providing you with good information to allow you to make decisions. Talked about holding meetings in public. On the horizon, the fall now. The Municipal Elections Act should come out sooner than that. In fact, we saw a piece of that yesterday with the voting system that's going to come into effect. That's going to be fascinating. I had an observation from a friend saying if anybody goes to this new voting system, the clerks are going to have to become mathematicians. And you may get your voting results about 3 days after the election because they'll be in there calculating first, second, and third. It's going to be very interesting. Municipal acts under review, maybe the fall. And the Municipal Conflict of Interest Act is under review. I'm not optimistic on that. There was a bit of a desire to do it, and my sense is it's kind of waning a little bit. This act has been in since 1972. It had one major amendment in 1986, and not much since. There's been no appetite by the province. They had a bill put through, but they never brought it into effect in the early 90s. There's been no real interest in it. The good news is that if it gets amended, it may be clearer in some respects. The bad news is it may be even stricter than it is today. So we'll have to wait and see. Okay, this is my kind of top 10 list. You need to make a difference. You need to know each other's roles and respect those. You need to read the procedure bylaw. My test for clerks, by the way, is that they read it once a month, cover to cover. Yeah, it's good clerks do it. They need to know where things are in a hurry. It's really important. You need to have well-constructed agendas that flow appropriately for the types of business that you're dealing with. And sometimes they get out a little bit out of whack. So doing a procedure bylaw, again, there's a really good opportunity to look at that. You need really well-written, comprehensive staff reports to allow you to make good decisions. Everybody needs to be prepared when you show up at the meetings, I think is absolutely critical. Take out the surprises. When you walk through the door, you know what you're going to deal with. You need to be accountable and transparent. Read your policy to know exactly what that means. You need to have a well-defined relationship with the public, not just in terms of meetings, but generally speaking, how you interact. I heard about town meetings. There are a number of different things that you can do, and they really become significant. The more you can reach out and get in from the community, I think the better you are. Culture of ongoing training, again, that's really good. The best municipalities err on the side of formality. In other words, if you have a chance to be informal or formal, be a little bit more formal. It really works, in my experience, at the end of the day. You're in a complex world. You have huge liabilities on this corporation and in some respects on you personally. You need to know and understand what they are and how they function around you. Power rests with you. Understand your role. Understand everybody else's role as well. Your personal obligations. Did I ask the question about safe drinking? Do you have drinking water systems? The region. Okay. At the region, have you all been trained on it? Hope so. Different world out there underwater now than it used to be. Pretty serious stuff. Do your homework. It's really important to do. I'm done. Thank you for this. I'm astounded at how much people paid attention. I love the questions. I thought there were some really interesting questions today. That's important. And if you take your head back to November 18th, the level of question was way different today than it was back then. Not because you're smarter now, but you have more experience and you have some context. I really commend you for doing this partway through the term. And I thank you for the opportunity. For me, this is fun.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Is there any other questions, comments? Mayor Thompson?
Yes, I want to say thank you very much for
sorry, Mayor Thompson, can you put your mic on? Thank you. Thank you.
Fred, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. I've taken your courses for as long as I've been on Municipal Council. Your guidance has been great. You're a terrific mentor, and I think to all the council. I think it's very tough for a lot of us to get away to the programs. A lot of times they get filled up before we can get registered, just knowing what our schedule is. I think this works extremely well, that all council benefits the what you have to share. And thank you very much for coming in, because we have a huge role here to represent the public, and we want to do the best job we can, and with that is getting the good advice. So thank you very much for coming in and sharing your expertise.
Anyone else? Thank you. just going to adjourn the meeting.